Time to take a look at your pet's health here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. She's a clinical instructor at UW. It's great to have her back. She comes by once a month to visit with us. And today we're going to be talking about keeping fleas off your pet and out of your home. We'll talk about pet seizures and also how to make the 4th of July week pet friendly. So, questions for her. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
It is nice to be here, Larry.
So, summer is the prime flea season.
It is, but you know what? That is one of the misconceptions, because they can be an issue in your home all year if you've got the right conditions and so on. The reason I wanted to bring this up, it was very surprising to me. There was a Harris poll that interviewed 1,300 pet owners, and they were asked about flea and tick control and the number of misconceptions about whether your pet needs it or not was just amazing. Only 33%, a third, a third of people, I shouldn't say only, but a third of people will give regular flea control and tick control to their pets. And 50% only say that they use it year-round. And you know, in our part of the country, ticks are definitely a year-round problem. Fleas, maybe not so much. But one of the big misconceptions is that if you have a pet that's indoors, you don't have to worry about fleas. And I always use the example of a friend of mine who had three indoor cats. And she was, this was very stupid of her, but feeding wild raccoons on her back porch.
Uh-huh.
Raccoons and possums are probably our two, and stray cats, okay, but are probably the biggest carriers of the flea that infects our dogs and cats. And they don't even have to be around to, there with direct contact. Fleas lay eggs, they roll off, they get into the environment. And when the temperatures are such as they are, as summer goes on and it's warm and humid and moist, those eggs hatch and turn into larvae, turn into an adult flea. And the owner, my friend, walking in and out, probably inadvertently brought them in on her own clothing because her cats were strictly indoors, and transmitted them to her cats. Needless to say, her house became flea infested. And it's amazing how fast that population can just multiply and grow. So even indoor pets, there are times where we want to have them on flea and tick control. People that live in apartments that have communal areas that maybe dogs that are going in and out are walking, even if you've got a strictly indoor cat, should have their pets on flea control. Just because you're living in the city doesn't mean you don't need to have your pet on flea control, because, like I said, raccoons, possums, those urban wildlife are big carriers of it. And there are lots of safe products. I always recommend talking to your veterinarian to find out what would be best for your pet. Don't use dog products on cats. And, you know, when you're using it, use it as directed and make sure you know your pet's weight, so that you're using the right dose of the medication. And use it all year round, because in this area, we have ticks year round. So definitely one of those important things. The essential oils and things that are out there, none of them have been shown to be effective. But we have shown toxicity in many of them. Things like pennyroyal, which is very common. Applying that directly to the animal has been associated with everything from just being disoriented, vomiting and diarrhea, all the way to seizures and death. So, you know, even though it may sound like this sounds like a really nice thing to use, tea tree oil or pennyroyal oil, they may not be very safe. And so I'd be looking at probably it's safer to get something from your veterinarian or recommended over-the-counter product from your veterinarian. My favorite over-the-counter thing is something called the Seresto collar, which lasts for 8 months and is extremely safe for both dogs and cats.
Yeah. Adam in Madison has that exact question. Adam, is this what Sandy just said help you out?
It does. For my dog, but also, what kind of can you make your own ingredients to put around the yard that's environmentally safe?
That's a really good question. I don't know of anything that you can make on your own that would be effective. There are things for ticks, like called tick tubes, that are permethrin-laced cotton balls that mice and things will take them back to their burrows. But again, you're using an insecticide in your yard. But that is something that I have not heard of anything that is going to be effective. Your best way of protecting your pet, rather than treating the whole yard, which is going to also treat other insects, would be to treat your pet and using something that's going to be pet safe. The reason why I brought up the Seresto collar and your question is what is good for the environment. That particular chemical in the collar, especially if you have a dog that's swimming, I'm always concerned about collars and other things that the ingredients may wash off into our waterways and have an effect on our wildlife by coming leaching out of the collar. This particular collar, it works by friction, and it's not been shown to leach out of the collar when the dog gets wet. It does come off. That small amount that's penetrated into the dog's coat will come off, but that residual amount in the collar that lasts for 8 months stays there. So I look at that as one of the most environmentally safe, besides the oral flea and tick products that you can give to dogs and the ones that are going to stay on the dog's coat, like fipronil, which is the base of Frontline. That only comes off because it gets down into the pores and coats the hair as it comes off if you use a good pore flushing, degreasing shampoo to get it off. So that would be another very safe one for dogs that are out in the, swimming and things like that to use in the environment.
There you go, Adam. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Bob in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I have a 14-and-a-half-year-old Siamese female. She's a mix, so she's mostly more domestic short hair than Siamese, but she's had an ongoing respiratory issues for several years now. And initially, I tried Clavamox and doxycycline, and they worked initially, but one of them made her really lethargic and sick, so I stopped that and took her in for exam. They know what it isn't, but they don't know what it is. So now she's on prednisone and occasionally an injection of Convenia, but it's not really helping her at all. At best, it keeps it at bay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But she still sneezes a lot, and she'll sneeze very, very hard, and sometimes she sprays it all over.
Oh, my goodness.
There's so much
nasal discharge. Yeah. I was going to ask you what type of respiratory problem your cat has, because cats are kind of the poster child for asthma, but that's more of a lung condition where they're having respiratory breathing problems with their lungs. What you're describing is a chronic upper respiratory problem. And unfortunately, they're very common in cats. And things that we get concerned about are cats that have been previously infected with some of these upper respiratory viruses can have enough damage done to their nasal passages that then they're predisposed to having chronic bacterial infections. But being a 14-year-old cat, if this was an acute problem, it was just starting, I'd be thinking about things like nasal tumors or foreign bodies. But the way you've described it, it's been going on a long time, and it sounds like it is a for a short period of time, an antibiotic responsive type problem. What I have found as an antibiotic that helps these cats that you can use and then get into using it a little less frequently is azithromycin, like the Z-Pak that people will take when they have a respiratory infection. And it is used off-label in cats, but that's been an antibiotic that I found to be well-tolerated by cats. And you can, use it at the initial rate and then get into just periodic use to be able to keep the respiratory infection under control. Obviously, anytime we're using antibiotics chronically, we always worry about resistant bacteria. And so things that you may want to consider doing to help your cat to make them feel more comfortable would be saline nasal drops like they make for babies. Again, trying to get your cat used to using those can be really difficult. Having your cat in a really humid room, like a bathroom where the shower's going, or Having a humidifier in a room may be helpful to help loosen some of those nasal secretions. But it just comes down to long-term chronic management. And I'm sorry, there really isn't any other suggestions of things that I can give you.
And what was the name of that product you mentioned?
The azithromycin. Okay, it's an antibiotic. It's a human antibiotic that many people know it as the Z-Pack that you'll get. That you give like a double dose to start with, and then you get into a lower dose. Yeah.
And you have to worry about the cat's weight and all that when you're applying?
Yeah, that, and it's because it's a prescription product, you'd have to get it through your veterinarian. And because it's a human medication, your veterinarian may have to get it if they don't carry it in their pharmacy through a human pharmacy. So it's there may be some hoops to jump through. It's not something that you can get easily. I always recommend keeping cats on lysine as well. Lysine is a amino acid that you can use. It's available in treats and so on, and powders and gels that helps, especially with cats with chronic herpes. There's some debate. There's been some research that says it may not help. But the thing is, it can't hurt. And cats typically really like the treat form of it. So you can get them over the counter, and that may be helpful too.
All right. There you go, Bob. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in too with your pet health question. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Michael in Kakana has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Michael. Oh, we lost Michael.
Oh.
That gives us the opportunity to talk about seizures. Watching your pet have a seizure, a very difficult thing.
Oh, my goodness.
What should and what shouldn't you do?
Well, one of my dogs has seizures, and I have witnessed, my husband's witnessed one, and I've witnessed one. And I can tell you, even as a veterinarian, to see your pet seizure is one of the hardest things that can happen. And number one, okay, you want to remain calm. Okay, if you see your pet having a seizure, is try to remain calm so you don't get your pet more upset either. Keep your hands away from their face. They're not going to choke on their tongue. They're, you know, and I've seen owners injure themselves because they hear that old wives' tale. And so keep your hands away from their face. Try to keep them away from sharp objects like the edge of a fireplace or a sharp table or stairs where they may injure themselves as well. If you can, really try to think back while it's still fresh in your mind, what were the dog's behavior? What was the dog's behavior before the seizure, during the seizure? Because it's really going to be helpful to know, kind of, you know, diagnose it as a seizure disorder, and then after the seizure. And setting a timer or looking at your watch and saying, how long is this seizure lasting? It may seem like hours, but it may only be a minute or two. But that is really helpful because those are going to all be things that you're going to be asked. And if possible, videotape the pet. Obviously, you may not have your phone handy or anything like that. But if you do, get a video of it. And call your veterinarian. When should you see your vet? Well, even if the seizure is just a very short one, the pet recovers fine and, you know, no aftermath like what happens with my dog. He's only had two in the last year. They need to be seen, but it's not urgent. And during that appointment, we want to be, you know, evaluating things like what medications you're giving your dog. We'll probably get some blood work to rule out metabolic problems like liver disease and blood sugar issues and so on that could potentially be causing seizures. And we'll talk about whether we need to start your dog on an anticonvulsant. Typically, we don't right away. We wait until the dog is having anywhere from 4 to 12 seizures a year. Some neurologists recommend if they're having seizures that are even short, every 3 months to have them get started on an anticonvulsant medication. Some recommend waiting until they're having them at least once a month. But my own dog on two seizures, he's had two seizures in a year. The medications that we use, besides the expense and the monitoring, it's just and the side effects and, you know, risks and so on.
Sure.
It's just not worth using. He doesn't drive a car. He holds a job and he's in our house and he's in a safe environment. So I'm not that concerned. So I'm not going through treatment. when you should see a veterinarian immediately, meaning if it's happening in the middle of the night, you got to get them to one of those overnight emergency clinics, is if the seizures lasted for more than 5 minutes, that's where timing it becomes really important, or if there's more than two in 24 hours, which we start calling cluster seizures. Those are going to be seizures that we become really concerned about. Those are harder to stop, and they can lead to hyperthermia, and those are ones that we really need to look at as an emergency. So number one, you know, take a deep breath, don't worry, and, you know, just follow my advice and call your vet either, you know, as soon as possible if it's a very short seizure and they've gotten over it, or if you're uncomfortable, by all means, any emergency clinic would be more than willing to talk to you or see your dog in the middle of the night if you feel that it's necessary for your dog.
There you go. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Tyler Ditter, our engineer today. Jill Nadeau, our producer. And you are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Thanks for joining in. Questions, you can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us your pet photos or your pet questions to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Jody in Dubuque, Iowa has something for us. Sandy, let's go there. Hi, Jody.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment that I do have two outdoor cats that I had spayed, and they stay around the house. They're really good cats, but I was having some issues with one of the female cats, and she had some sinus problems, allergy problems also, which would have cost me like a ton of money to do that for an outdoor cat. So what I ended up doing was coconut oil. I give both of my cats an eighth a teaspoon of coconut oil in the morning and also one in the, at night with their meal, and it solved everything. It was amazing. I just couldn't believe it. You know, I just ran across it on a blog. You know, I did some of my own research. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to say that. So there are some really good holistic ideas out there, you know, if people, you know, want to go that route.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. You know, coconut oil is one of those kind of fad things that, you know, it cures everything from, you know, leprosy, which cats can get, by the way. They have their own form of leprosy, to, you know, whatever. And no, I'm glad it helped it's helping your cats. But there has been no documented scientific evidence that coconut oil is going to be effective. You could apply it topically to your cats and you'd probably get just about as best effect. But if it's working for your cats, it's not going to hurt your cat. But I just don't want people that have a pet that has a serious respiratory infection to be thinking that that may help them. So I'm glad it helped your cat and it saved you some money. But boy, oh boy, I don't think that any of my colleagues would be agreeing with you that it's something that you would try as a first line defense for respiratory problems in cats.
There we go. Jody, thank you so much. Appreciate it. David in Appleton, we'll go to you. Hi, David.
Hello. I appreciate you taking my phone call. I have a kind of a complicated case, but I thought I'd call just to see. I have a 9-year-old English Shepherd that was recently diagnosed with lung cancer. The complicated part is our initial vet took x-rays, didn't do any blood work, didn't take his temperature, just took x-rays and diagnosed him. So we were a little confused. I took him to a secondary vet, and she looked at the x-rays, took more x-rays, and the lungs, I supposedly, are supposed to look black, and his x-rays, they look cloudy. And she said if it was cancer, it should look like cotton balls. She wasn't thinking that it was cancer, and she put him on some heavy-duty antibiotics, and I apologize, I don't know the name of them. And they initially seemed to help a little bit, but then after about a month, he coughed up some blood.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we thought at that point, well, they were right. He has cancer, but he hasn't, it's been a couple months since then. He hasn't coughed up any blood. He only coughs. This all started because he started to cough when we'd walk through the front door. He'd get excited and he'd cough.
Mm-hmm.
And it only happens when he gets excited, like if he runs a lot or like if we walk in through the front door, he coughs for about 30 seconds and then he stops.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally brought him to a third vet and for just a final opinion. And she thought the same thing. She goes, she listened to his lungs, felt that his lungs sounded good. And then she pressed on his near his throat and his upper chest and made him cough.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's on steroids right now.
Okay.
And, you know, I know it's a lot.
Yeah.
But just wasn't sure if you have any opinions or thoughts or guidance. Yeah.
What I would be strongly recommending, since you're getting three different opinions, and none of them, I at least from what I'm getting from what you've said, are radiology specialists or internal medicine specialists, correct?
Correct.
Correct, yeah. You can, I mean, I know that you can get copies of your x-rays, even if they're digital or print copies or whatever, however your veterinarian has them, and get a second opinion on those x-rays. And that would be something that, this would be a fourth opinion on the x-rays, but having them evaluated by a veterinary radiologist. And I know that the UW-Madison Vet School, veterinarians send in radiographs all the time there to be able to get a second opinion. You know, there are so many things that can cause cloudy lungs, everything from infections like pneumonia, fungal infections, which your dog being on steroids would get worse. And if it was something like blastomycosis, they'll get worse pretty quickly. So it's probably unlikely to be anything like that. But I have seen dogs live with lung cancer for a fairly long period of time, sometimes for several months before they succumb to it. So I'm really, with the fact that your dog has been coughing up blood, even though it was just one time, that is of some concern. Is your dog on heartworm preventative?
Yes, he is.
And been heartworm tested and so on. Okay. Because I mean, sometimes that can be an issue, but, you know, I really think that since you're getting these differences of opinion, it's time to probably either see a specialist or at least get his most current radiographs reevaluated by someone so that you can get a better idea of what's going on.
So you would go to your local vet and say, hey, can you send this to...
Yeah, yeah. And it happens all the time. There is a small consultation fee to be able to look at the radiographs, but it does sometimes give owners that peace of mind or help them get on the path of getting the correct diagnosis because the radiologist is able to look at them. And I know for me, as a veterinarian, lungs are one of the hardest things to look at and be able to interpret correctly. Bones, no problem. Lungs, for me, I mean, that's still one of those kind of mystery organs that I look at, and I walk back to radiology all the time and say, tell me what's going on, you know, and they're very helpful to be able to get that done. And I hope you can get some answers for your dog, because 9 years old is young for a large breed dog that's in the shepherd family. Usually they're living into their teens, and so I hope that you can get some answers and the right treatment.
Yeah, good luck, David. Maybe let us know how things turn out. I appreciate your call. Holly in Ogama, your turn now. Hi, Holly. Holly, are you there?
Cat. And he throws up a lot.
All right, so we got a 14-year-old cat. Holly, you're breaking up a little bit. So we have a 14-year-old cat that throws up after eating.
Yeah. You know, there are some cats that this is just their piggy cats. They eat a lot, and if they eat too much at one time, they're going to purge. But for the majority of kitties, that if they just start this, and especially if they're 14, it's time to have them evaluated if you haven't done that already. What I would be doing is, besides a head-to-toe physical exam, I'd be probably getting some blood work done. Big things that I worry about are, does the cat have some gastric irritation secondary to maybe renal disease, or are they eating a lot because they have an issue such as hyperthyroidism, an overactive thyroid gland? Do they have something primarily wrong with their GI tract, or something outside the GI tract like pancreatitis that can be very chronic in cats and not acute like it is in dogs? So if you haven't taken your kitty to a veterinarian, this is the time to do it, to get this cat, while it's hopefully, you know, still healthy and doing okay, if there's something that's found, it can be treated earlier rather than later. It always saddens me when somebody sits and waits and waits and waits, and then we get this kitty in that's emaciated and not doing well, and they may not be the best candidates for treatment because they have so many other issues going on now that they've waited so long. So early rather than later is my motto.
Good luck, Holly. Thank you very much for calling. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's take some emails. Betty emailed that she's had to have her dog euthanized last week. Sorry for that. Received his ashes yesterday. Is it common to have bone fragments among the ashes?
It is. In fact, I just went to a noon seminar put on by one of our local pet crematoriums, and they talked about the whole process of pet cremation. And this would be the same as it is for human cremation as well. When they're cremated, the soft tissues are obviously burned, but the bones remain. And they do have to go through a crusher to be able to give them to you. And so sometimes it depends on, you know, how well those bones are crushed to be able to put them in the cremains container to come, you know, send them home. But that is perfectly normal to see little bits of fragments of bone. It is sometimes I've opened up my own pet's cremains, and you look at it and you go, ooh, but that is normal. And again, I'm very sorry for your loss. And I hope having your pet's cremains helps bring you some peace of mind that, you know, your pet is going to be with you for a long, long time to come.
Thank you, Betty. Kenneth says his Chinese crested dog has raised round bumps that appear in different areas, but then they go away after a while. I'm wondering what that could be.
Wow. A Chinese crested, they come in either the hairless form that just has a little bit of hair on their head and maybe on their tail and feet, and the rest of their body is bald, to ones that actually have hair. And I always worry about sun exposure and if this dog is getting some type of irritation from being out in the sun. It sounds like the dog is getting hives, and I'm wondering if the fact that they're coming and going, whether it's insect bites or something that the dog's being exposed to outside because they don't have that natural protection of having a hair coat. It would be a good idea if you can take pictures of these areas, especially if they go away by the time you take your dog to your veterinarian so that they can look at them and see what they look like, or give your veterinarian a heads up that, hey, the next time my dog has this problem, can I come in because I need to have them looked at. That might be the best way to be able to figure out what they may potentially be. But if you're looking for an over-the-counter remedy, if they're not bothering your dog and the dog's comfortable, you may want to see if they just regress with Benadryl, which is diphenhydramine. You can use a generic form and you can get it over the counter, but I'd check with your veterinarian as to what dose to consider using.
Cindy in Antioch, Illinois. We'll turn to you now. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. I have a 12-year-old lab mix who has about a month ago been diagnosed with a malignant tumor. I didn't know he had anything going wrong, no change in diet or activity, but I did notice a walnut-sized lump beneath his neck, on his neck, and had very bad breath, and he'd been gagging a little while. So when I took him into the vet, she inspected the mouth, and he has a cauliflower type of tumor that's on his inside his mouth, and she told me it's going to proceed down his throat until he no longer will be comfortable. Right now, he's taking clindamycin and prednisone just for precautionary purposes or to make him more comfortable, but I just don't know how long, if I should get a second opinion. Of course, surgery is going to be out of the question.
Yeah. Without knowing what kind of tumor it is, that's going to be very difficult to give you some answers. You know, there are easy ways to get answers. You've got a lump on your dog's neck. It may be a lymph node, especially if the mass is in the mouth. The regional lymph nodes may be affected by the same type of tumor that's affecting your dog's mouth. That would might be a very easy place in an awake patient to be able to do a needle biopsy to be able to get some answers. Tumors in the mouth, boy, they can present. They basically all look the same. That we can see some that are pigmented, like melanomas, that may help with giving your answer right there if you've got a pigmented mass. But because many dogs have pigmented gum tissue, even some of the other tumors that we can see, like fibrosarcomas and squamous cells and so on, can be they can all look alike. So that would be my first thing to say, is if you want to get more answers, get a biopsy done, either of the oral mass, which would require anesthesia, or at least of the lymph node to be able to get some answers. There are, for things like oral melanomas in dogs, I am not an oncologist, by the way, so I'm hoping none of my oncologist colleagues are listening to me. But for things like an oral melanoma in dogs, which tend to be very highly malignant, there is a melanoma vaccine that you can use that has been helpful in some patients. Radiation therapy would be another thing to consider. But again, you'd have to probably debulk the mass, taking away some of the surrounding normal tissue, take the infected lymph node out, stage your dog. There's a whole lot of steps to get to that point where you can have your dog undergo radiation therapy. But it doesn't sound like that's in the cards for your dogs and your dog. And I totally understand. It's a hard decision to make, but know that there are treatments and things that can be done, that some may be very non-invasive and some are more invasive. And I wish you a good luck with your dog.
Good luck, Cindy, and thank you very much for calling. Well, let's take another caller here. Dick in Oak Creek has something for us. Hi, Dick.
Hi there. I got a couple of questions for you. We have a rescue kitty. We've had her for 14 months. She's 3 years old. And a couple of months ago, she decided that she didn't like canned food anymore. And she loves dry food. And I'm wondering, I heard somewhere that you really shouldn't give a kitty all the dry food. I wonder if that's true or not.
Well, I like to see cats get a variety of things, because you never know in their life when you may have to switch them to something that may be in a canned formulation. But sounds like your cat has developed a food preference for dry. Really, the only difference between dry food and wet food is the moisture content. Obviously, wet food is much higher in moisture than the dry food. And so for some cats that are not really good drinkers, that may need extra water for certain reasons, certain bladder conditions and renal diseases and things like that, where we want to make sure that they stay really well hydrated, wet foods would be better. But staying on dry food alone, if that's what your cat wants to eat, that's fine. I have no problem with that. But just make sure that you've got plenty of water available in a form that the cat likes to drink from, whether that be a kitty water fountain or, certain water bowls, dripping faucet, whatever that may be.
Tell you, my cats are the pickiest eaters ever.
Mm-hmm.
You can't introduce anything new. They will just ignore it.
Yeah, and cats are like that. They're very neophobic, okay? They get used to certain things, and that's all they want. My 18-year-old kitty that I have at home, he will only eat canned right now, partially because over his life he's managed to have to lose several teeth, but he also has kidney disease, and I'm really happy that he eats wet food, because that's helping to head off that point in his life where he may need subcutaneous fluids to be able to maintain his hydration.
Oh. And Dick, thank you again. Appreciate your call. I've had some listeners call in who want to know how to spell Seresto.
It's S-E-R-E-S-T-O. Seresto. Yeah.
S-E-R-E-S-T-O.
And it's made by the Bayer Company, and it is available over the counter. And it's probably the safest and collar around that I both for dogs and cats. And in fact, it's got the same chemical in the dog formulation as in the cat formulation. And they're gray. They come with some little reflective bling, but you can use them very safely.
All right. There we go. Gregory in Turtle Lake. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, I've got a 10-year-old, I think she's a mostly Australian Shepherd, and she's always had the urinary tract problems, and lately she's been really straining to go, and it takes her a long time, and it's a real weak stream, and I give her a prednisone every once in a while, and I'm not sure if that's helping or not. Do you have any advice?
Why are you giving the prednisone? Is that something your veterinarian recommended?
Yeah, he thought that would help.
Okay. Things that I worry about, one, your dog shouldn't be straining. Obviously, now we're talking about comfort issues for your dog. And the fact that the stream is narrower than normal, I worry about some type of obstructive problem. And being a 10-year-old dog, this could be anything from bladder stones to serious bladder wall inflammation, all the way to a bladder wall tumor. And your dog does need to have some evaluation done. The first thing to start with is having a urine sample looked at for cells and how well your dog's concentrating the urine, whether there's blood present, bacteria present, and then potentially a culture as well. And then probably some imaging, which would entail either just getting plain x-rays to evaluate for some types of stones, a contrast study x-ray, or preferably a urinary tract ultrasound to be able to have a better look at what's going on with the bladder. So I hope that gets your dog some answers and you some answers so that your dog can be comfortable. She should not be straining. And you know, using an anti-inflammatory for something like bladder stones or an infection is not going to be helpful at all, or even a tumor.
Yeah, there you go, Gregory. Thank you for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org right here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in today. We'll take some more calls right now. Willem in Colfax has something for us, Sandy, so let's go there. Hi, Willem.
Hi. We have a cat that has hyperthyroidism, and currently we're treating him with that methimazole, I think it's called.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering about, is that something that someone can do long term? I know that people have talked about that radiation thing, but that's really expensive and kind of anyway. Or any, I read on the internet, which is not necessarily good information, about some homeopathic medicines for hyperthyroidism. Do you know anything about those things?
The only treatments that are available that we know work for treating hyperthyroidism are methimazole in its various forms, and cats can be on it very long term. We often diagnose cats when they're in their early teens and they stay on it through the rest of their life. Radiation therapy, which is not radiation therapy, radioactive iodine treatment, which has a really good track record of being fairly long-term treatment, but some cats will develop another nodule and need to go through treatment again. And then a very iodine-restricted diet that's called YD that the Hill's Company makes. when they're on that diet, that's all they can eat. They can't get treats. They can't eat anything else. And it becomes an issue for multi-cat households because the cost of that diet is about the same as treating with methimazole. So I'd keep your cat on the methimazole because, you know, any other, you know, online recommended treatment, the risk that your cat would have with becoming hyperthyroidism again would be to become cardiotoxic again and develop a heart murmur and secondary heart disease, severe muscle wasting. It's, you know, it's really sad to see these kitties that come in just wasted and within heart failure when it's something that can be treated. And so I'd stay with the methimazole. If you're having trouble giving the tableted form of methimazole, it is available in a bio gel that has to be made through a formulating pharmacy. But that is a little bit easier to use, obviously more expensive, but it's applied to the inside of the ear. And you just, you know, put a little dab of the pre-measured stuff on the inside of the ear and it's absorbed through the skin. And that works very well for cats. And so some owners like to switch to that because they're having difficulty pilling the kitty. So I'm not sure which form you're using. Yeah.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Paula near Lake Geneva emailed to ask how she can find a dog behaviorist. Her dog was attacked at a dog park. And although he wasn't physically hurt, he's now very afraid of other dogs.
Yeah. They're few and far between, but they're becoming more and more available for use. And what I would be recommending is going to the AVSAB, American Veterinary Society for Animal Behavior website to look. And on that site, you can see for where available specialists are. In the Madison area, we have some applied animal behaviorists, but no veterinary specialists from the standpoint of they've gone through a residency program and special testing to be able to become board certified in veterinary behavior. There are closest veterinary board certified veterinary behaviorists are down in the Chicago area. So you may have to travel a little bit. But again, talking to your veterinarian to find out who in their area they would recommend that you see, because there are many applied animal behaviorists that can do an excellent job, may not be able to write prescriptions to help your dog, but may be able to work with your veterinarian to come up with not only a desensitization and counter conditioning program to get your dog more comfortable to being around other dogs, but maybe medical management that may help your dog as well.
Carol in Randolph emailed that she's looking at getting a new puppy soon. She keeps reading about socialization being very important from a young age. She's also heard that it's very risky to expose your puppy to new dogs and children before they have had all their immunizations. Can you explain?
Well, first of all, I don't know what the issue with children would be because there really aren't a lot of diseases that children are going to be able to give to your puppy. And I think it's really important for young dogs to get exposed to dog-savvy children so that they start learning that humans come in all different shapes and sizes. But when you look at, there was a study done, this was several years ago, looking at the statistics on dogs that are being relinquished to shelters. The number one predictive factor for a dog being relinquished to a shelter before a year of age was that they didn't go to dog training classes or socialization puppy training classes when they were young. So that's how important this really is. And so when you're taking your dog to training classes, it's kind of like sending your child to kindergarten. It's so important that they go, but yes, your child may end up with a contagious disease from one of the other, or a parasite or something from one of the other kids there. You wouldn't keep your kid out of school for that reason. We do the same thing with dogs. So if you're working with a training class, they're going to require that your dog have a veterinarian have a look at your dog and certify that they're healthy at the time of evaluation. Probably want a negative stool sample for parasites, as well as being started on their vaccines, including getting a Bordetella vaccine. And then, when you're in these training classes, you know, if you've, there's a sick dog, obviously they're not going to be coming. Hopefully they know to keep their pet away. They should be on a surface that's washable and easily cleanable, so that if a dog does have an accident, the things like fecal material and so on that can transmit parasites and some viral and infectious diseases are able to be cleaned up before your pet gets exposed to it. I would never take a puppy to the dog park or an area where you don't know who the dogs are there. There's no one supervising and it's not a cleanable surface. So that would be a spot to avoid. I also wouldn't take my dog to a local pet store because there's no one there ensuring that the dogs that are walking through the door are going to be a good a meet and greet for your dog, either health-wise or behavior-wise. So training classes are going to be the safest place for your pet to go. And it's worth the small, insignificant chance of your dog getting sick to be able to have a more mentally and physically well-balanced dog.
And it's really important at that very young age.
It really is. We want to get them in classes as early as possible. Probably, you know, anywhere from like 8 weeks and up, we like to see dogs get started.
Juliana in Muskego, we'll go to you next. Hi, Juliana.
Hi there. I have a 15-year-old long-haired cat. In fact, we think she might be part Maine Coon. Always very healthy. Always kept herself really clean, and I brush and groom her. About 3 months ago, she started developing some mats in her fur toward her hind end, and I thought it could be because she's getting older and maybe not as flexible. But I had all the mats brushed out, and I was away from home for 2 weeks. She didn't get brushed, and I came back, and she's very matted, and she does not want me to even touch her lower body near her hind legs or even her lower back. And she's going to the vet tomorrow, but I just thought I'd check and see if you know any physical conditions that could contribute to that.
Yeah, anything that makes a cat not feel good, they may not groom. Think about the last time that you had the flu. You know, did you wash your hair and dry your hair and put on your makeup? Probably not. So I'd be looking for underlying illnesses that the cat may be living with, but just not feeling 100%. Cats are masters of hiding illness. And so often we have to be doing our physical exam, getting our blood work to be able to find out if something's wrong with your cat. The other big thing would be arthritis. And again, cats are great at hiding arthritis. We take our dogs for walks. We take them, you know, take them in areas where we're going to be able to see that they're not moving as well or as comfortable. Cats tend to hide it. You know, you may see her be a little less active, jumping up on furniture and things, but often you may not even see them limping. But just that act of having to get in the position to be able to groom themselves, they may not be able to do that. And obesity. As cats get overweight, they can't get back there and groom themselves. I just had to give my 18-year-old cat what they call a lion cut. He's got fur on his feet and around his head because he just, between being arthritic and having kidney disease, he was not grooming himself. And I was having exactly the same issue where it was just easier to get clippers and get him shaved down. And he is so much happier and more comfortable. So that might be something to talk to your veterinarian about, is getting some of that excessive hair taken away.
Yeah, good idea. Thanks, Juliana. Mike in Greenbush, your turn. Hi, Mike. Perhaps we lost
Hello.
Hello.
Mike?
Oh, I'm not in Greenbush. I'm in Appleton.
Oh, sorry.
Okay.
Oh, you're Michael. Okay.
That's right.
All right. What's on your mind?
Okay. What's on my mind is my Torty cat, and she's about 7.5 years old, and she's got a problem near her tail on her back. That is, the hair has become very thinned out for about four inches or so, and maybe a half inch wide. The vet has prescribed a product called Revolution Plus. And we've given her her first dose, but I understand that's going to be a thing that takes about 6 months or more. There are no insects or mites or anything that we've seen around the house, and the cat has been a 100% indoor cat. The only other issue I have before solve this problem is that the vet has also prescribed that the cat wear a cone around her neck or over her head, and that really sets the cat into a kind of catatonic, as it were.
Cats don't enjoy using one of the Elizabethan collars. There are some soft ones that are flexible, that are a little more well-tolerated by cats, but some cats just don't like using them. But I can see why your veterinarian wanted to do that, to see, is your cat doing the over-grooming in this area? When we have a cat that has been barbering their hair coat and losing hair in particular areas, sometimes you can pluck the hair out and look under the microscope and see that the ends are all frayed and barbered. That tells us that the cat has been chewing. Another method is using the e-collar method, and that is also sometimes therapeutic. But the flea treatment, yes, that's always our first thing, is to treat them for fleas. Because remember what I said at the beginning of the show, even indoor pets can pick up fleas. You can bring them in and they may be there. So we like to go through a flea trial before we jump to the next diagnostics.
There we go, Michael. Thank you so much for calling. Our guest today, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. She'll be with us right up till 12:30 today. We'll take a look at the news, the weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we'll be back with Dr. Sandy. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your pet's health today on the Ideas Network, I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her back. Questions, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we have Mike from Greenbush up with a question for you, or an experience to share, Dr. Sandy. Let's go there. Mike, hi.
Hi. Hello, Larry. There was a comment about arthritis before, and I had a friend. She had six rescue dogs, and the oldest one was a 14-year-old Rottweiler female who had been used for a puppy mill. It was in a lot of pain. I can recall just seeing her move, and it hurt me to see her walking around. And I came up with a simple treat. I gave her some dog bones and put some coconut oil on the dog bone, and after about a week, I don't know whether it was the oil, but it made some noticeable improvements in that dog and a couple of the other dogs. Their coats seemed to glisten a little bit more. So whether there's any scientific or medical use for coconut oil, I can't say, but I sure saw the difference in this 14-year-old female Rottweiler and how much more limber she just seemed like she was out of a lot of pain because of the coconut oil.
Oh, I'm glad that it helped her. You know, the big concern I have is it is very caloric. It's about 120 calories per tablespoon. So when you have a dog that has arthritis, often weight control is one of our huge issues with helping them and making them feel more comfortable, is getting some of those pounds off. And now we're adding something that may give them extra calories and so on. There has been documented evidence that fish oil is very helpful for dogs with arthritis. And there was a study done at the UW where they actually did force plate analysis, which is where you have a dog not on it, and then they go on something like this, and they watch how they bear weight on their affected limbs. And it takes several weeks to be effective, but using fish oil at a pretty high dose, 100 milligrams per kilogram of body weight, which we usually just recommend getting it from one of the big box stores. But that has been shown to be, as a nutritional supplement, very good for treating arthritis. But I'm glad the dog did better and didn't get pancreatitis or an upset tummy from it or gain a lot of weight. Not surprised that the coat did better because, again, you are adding some fats to the dog's diet and it may be reflected through the hair coat as well. But, there are other things that may be superior than coconut oil.
And, you know, if you've often talked about a site where people can go to get really good information on research and so forth.
Yeah, there's a couple of places that I really like to go for pet food questions is the blog from Tufts University called Pet Foodology. Excellent place to go and read wonderful veterinary nutritionist based articles on pet food and all the different issues and things that are out there. Veterinary Partners is the other place that I like to go to. This is for pet owners to go to. That's a subsidiary of a site that I use all the time called VIN, Veterinary Information Network. Any pet owner can go there. You don't need a membership. You can plug in that information and you'll get up-to-date client education material on so many different topics that's often one of the first places I send owners to look for information.
And Mike, thanks again. Appreciate your call very much. Alan Wild Rose, we'll go to you now. Hi, Al.
Yeah, hi, Sandy. I've got a question about grain-free diet. So we've been feeding our dog a grain-free diet, and we have heard that there can be some heart issues, especially with a grain-free diet with legumes. And I am wondering if it's worth changing over to a diet with grain. And if I do, what do I look for in that diet?
Yeah, this has been something that for many months has been being looked at. And even the FDA has come out with the report that owners should use caution when feeding grain-free diets that are high in peas and legumes. But the whole issue is what we call BEG diets, the boutique, exotic ingredients, and grain-free. We really don't know kind of all of those diets seem to be having an issue with causing taurine deficiency or something else in certain dogs. And there's been well over 300 cases of dogs with heart disease, namely dilated cardiomyopathy caused by this being an issue for them. So by boutique diets, I mean those small companies that aren't doing diet testing. Are they starting out with enough taurine in the diet and then the processing decreases the amount? And then because they're not doing after production testing or after production feeding trials, it's getting released on the market and then your dog is the one that runs into trouble. Is it using exotic ingredients like ostrich or bison or kangaroo that although they're protein sources, they may have very different amino acid profiles and you can't just substitute one of those for beef or one of those for chicken and make this, you know, fabulously sounding diet without doing some extra studies to be able to know that particular protein source is going to provide everything that the dog needs. And then we have this issue with peas and legumes as being substituted, being used as part of the diet, and that's going to raise the protein. But because they are a vegetable source protein, they are low in taurine, I don't even know if they have taurine. And so as a result, the whole diet's going to be lower in taurine for some dogs. So I just tell people, you know, unless you really want to keep your dog on that grain-free diet because they're doing phenomenally well on it for whatever reason, there's no nutritional evidence that dogs need to be on a grain-free diet. It was a diet fad that was started several years ago and is now just taken off. And again, Dr. Google has promoted it as, you know, it's the cure-all for everything. Grains do not typically cause allergies. That tends to be the animal proteins in the food. In rare cases, they can. But go back to a grain regular diet for a pet. And I'd say stay with one of the big manufacturers that do post-manufacturer feeding trials so that you know that you are getting a diet that is safe to be fed to dogs.
And thanks, Al, for calling. Appreciate your call. Is there a place that, you know, the big companies and so forth, is there a site that actually rates them, or is it or what do you look for on the package that assures you that they've been tested?
That's a really good question. You want to look for on the package where it says the AFCO statement, which stands for American Association of Feed Control Officials. It will say on it, this food has been formulated to meet AFCO standards, which means they've made the recipe according to the way it should be made, and has gone through AFCO feeding trials and has been shown to be, you know, a food that will support, you know, adult dogs, puppies, all life stages, which is going to be anything that says all life stage has to be a puppy food. So so you're basically feeding a growth formula to an adult dog to be able to meet the puppy's needs. So
AFCO. AFCO. Look for that on the bag.
Yep.
All right. Lydia in Mount Horeb, on to you now. Hi, Lydia.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am wondering, I have a cat that never goes outside. She backs away from the door every time it's opened, in fact. Is it necessary that she has an annual feline distemper vaccination?
We typically don't use that vaccine annually anymore. The American Association of the American Feline Practitioners Association, the vaccine guidelines that are out say that once cats have gone through their kitten series, when they're a year of age, you can then, you know, vaccinate then and then go every 3 years. And yes, even indoor cats are at risk. And here's just a couple of scenarios. Your cat gets sick, hasn't been vaccinated, needs to go to a vet clinic. There they are in a clinic with other cats that could potentially be stressed and shedding diseases. You go to your local farmer's, you know, and pumpkin patch or whatever, and there are stray cats and things there that you bring the virus home on you with your clothing. Panleukopenia or cat distemper can survive for almost a year in the environment. It's a very stable virus. And so even indoor cats are not immune to getting that particular disease. So I always recommend that pets be kept up on vaccines, but by following the national guidelines and using them on a less frequent schedule will kind of meet your needs as well as the cat's needs and not be causing your cat to be over-vaccinated. And you will also get the all-important physical exam that your cat should be getting every single year by your veterinarian, head to toe, looking in the mouth, listening to the heart, assessing the weight, the coat, so on. Everything is looked at. And because, again, like I said earlier, cats are masters of hiding disease. And we find things that owners are often very surprised that we found in their kitty. So get your cat to your veterinarian.
There you go, Lydia. Thank you very much. Katie in Minocqua, your turn now. Hi, Katie.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm up here for the summer, and I have a poodle mix puppy, and we had given him the first dose of Lepto and Lyme vaccine, and it was a Zoetis brand, Vanguard.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were trying to give him the second dose up here without having to drive back to Waukesha, and they use Novavax. And I was wondering if there is any harm in giving.
Yeah, you've named two very reputable veterinary pharmaceutical companies that manufacture biologics, the vaccines, and they are both interchangeable. And in fact, we will sometimes change brands. It kind of depends on, you know, who's going to give the best pricing or whatever. And so it's not uncommon to see dogs get vaccinated for their first one with one brand and their second one with another one. And so absolutely no problem at all with switching brands. And important that while you're up north, you keep your dog on that schedule, because both of those diseases that you've named, leptospirosis and Lyme vaccine, if you miss that all-important booster vaccination in 2 to 4 weeks and you maybe go 6 weeks or longer between vaccinations, you have to start the series all over again.
No.
So it's better to just keep on schedule and have a local veterinarian up in the Monaco area help you and get that your puppy taken care of.
Good luck, Katie. Thank you so much. Craig in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Craig.
Hey, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I've got a 10-year-old English setter, and she's had two seizures, one last night, in the last 4 days. After the first one, we took her to the vet, of course, and she recovered and recognized us, but she was, the vet did blood tests, checked everything that was obvious, and said nothing showing up. You know, I don't know where to go with this. Earlier in the winter, she's normally a great athlete, and I ski with her frequently. She was lethargic after a short ski and following behind me rather than out in front, and I said, and then wobbling, I brought her to the vet at that time, and they diagnosed degenerative myelopathy, mm-hmm. but they did not do the genetic test. And then she recovered beautifully, and she was running like the wind. In fact, she ran yesterday prior to the seizure on a dog run with me. So I don't know what is going on with this 10-year-old, otherwise athletic English setter.
Yeah, you know, degenerative myelopathy, the thing that your dog was initially diagnosed with, is not something that gets better. That's a progressive degenerative disease of the spinal cord where the dog will start losing their ability to use their hind feet, their rear legs, and it just, you know, keeps progressing as time goes on. And so they don't get better from that. What I'm really concerned with is the fact that your dog is a 10-year-old dog and has just started to have seizures. Usually if they're in that 1 to 6-year-old range, most of those, about 80% of those dogs, are having what we call idiopathic epilepsy, which means probably genetic, not something we're going to be able to find an underlying cause for. But as you get older, we really worry about some type of organic disease going on in your dog's brain, such as a brain tumor. What I would be recommending, if blood work is normal, consider getting a second opinion from, if you want to go down this path, from a veterinary neurologist that has the ability, and most do, to be able to do some imaging of your dog's brain, to be able to see if there is a tumor or something there. Because sometimes those are in locations that can be managed either with radiation therapy, sometimes surgically, can be managed, or it may just give you an idea of what's going on and kind of what to expect. And so there's a whole host of diagnostic things that they do. They're taking chest x-rays and abdominal ultrasound. They'll often collect spinal fluid as part of this whole workup prior to doing an MRI. But there are things that can be done for your dog. And sometimes we'll just, if diagnostics are not in the cards, being an older dog that we're worried about tumors, may start your, I personally would probably start your dog in something like Keppra, which is a very safe anticonvulsant for older dogs with some underlying organic disease in their brain. So that might be something to consider.
There you go, Craig. Thank you so much. You know, Sandy, I mentioned at the start of the show, you know, we've got the 4th of July just around the corner, food, fun, fireworks.
Oh, yes. And I am so glad. I'm not glad that I've lost my dog, but I don't have a dog with thunderstorm phobia or noise phobia anymore. Bruce passed away last September, and it's totally changed the dynamics of the house. It is a difficult thing for pets to deal with, and we really have to give them a safe haven to be able to go to. That's number one. If they want to be in the bathtub, under the bed, down in the basement, remember, these dogs are terrified, and they need to have a safe spot. This is not the time of the year to be starting desensitization, but there are things that can be done, and we can definitely talk about that in another show. But this may be the time of the year where you just need some emergency medications for your dogs. And there's a number of drugs that we can use. None of them are going to be effective by the 4th of July that are these long-lasting drugs that you give every day, like fluoxetine and things like that. We're usually looking at using products like Celio, which is a transmucosal gel that you can use situationally. Things like alprazolam, Xanax is something that we will often use. Remember, it is not a shame to use medication. It is a humane thing for your pet. So don't be afraid to talk to your veterinarian about using something if necessary.
there are even over-the-counter medications that may be helpful too.
Oh.
And so looking at, you know, for long-term use, Nestle Purina has come out with a calming care probiotic. It's not something you use just once. It's, you have your dog on it all the time, but that's been found to be helpful with, you know, just as an adjunct to treatment. We will also use things like melatonin, which is available over-the-counter. That's
sure.
been found to be helpful. There are some other things that there's a product on the market called Composure Pro that you can get online or from your veterinarian. Anxietane is another one. They're all kind of natural products using things like milk protein, L-theanine, which is a very kind of natural type thing, not a prescription drug. And those have been helpful too. And even some things like botanical blends that maybe may help your dog. But just remember, if your dog is truly panicking, you may need to jump to those big guns of using a prescription from your veterinarian to be able to give your dog some relief during this time. But keep them indoors. Give them white noise. You know, shut the blinds. Do all those things to be able to make them feel more comfortable. Don't feel that you have to take them to your 4th of July parties, because that's not going to be the place for dogs to go. So,
Linda in Eau Claire has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I'm just questioning. We have a 15-year-old Papillon Bichon mix that has been losing her hair. We took her to the vet. He did a lot of lab work. It all came back normal. He put her on melatonin, 10 milligrams daily, and said sometimes that will help the hair regrowth. So that's been about 3 months, and I'm not seeing any improvement. He did talk about checking the thyroid again. So just wondering if you could give me any suggestions.
Well, whenever we have a dog or cat with hair loss, it's really important to look at the patterns of hair loss, where the pet is losing the hair. Are they losing guard hairs, their undercoat? Is it associated with weight gain, any other skin changes? I'm so glad that your veterinarian did some blood work, because the big endocrine diseases that we worry about in older pets are things like Cushing's disease, which is an overactive adrenal gland, or can sometimes be caused by medications like in the steroid family that we may be using in our pets, either orally, topically, such as chronic ear medications, especially in small breed dogs, can be a problem. Thyroid potentially could be a problem. And then, you know, I'd be also wanting to make sure that there are no underlying, you know, bacterial infections, things like mites. I have seen a couple of elderly patients develop a mite problem called Demodex. That all dogs have Demodex. They sit at a really low level in their body, but sometimes when pets become immunocompromised, as they get older, those mites become active and the hair follicles kind of give up the ghost when we've got these mites living in there. So I think that it may be time to go back and ask your veterinarian, did they do skin scrapings, and have a look around and make sure nothing else is there that could be causing your dog to be losing their hair. Because Papillons have beautiful hair coats.
Yeah, we don't want to see
a bald Papillon. Yeah.
Linda, thank you so much for calling. And Sandy, thank you so much. Always a pleasure. And you are back again on July 23rd.
I am. We'll see you next month, Larry.
Thank you so much. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk is a clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Again, she'll be back on July 23rd. So we'll look forward to that. Tomorrow at 11, we'll take a look at aquatic invasives and the 4th of July landing blitz. Then at 11:45, we'll talk about some great summer paddling routes for you, for your canoe or your kayak. So I hope you can join us for that. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.